Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 105 of Registry Matters. Saturday night, Larry, I'm back in my house. I'm all comfy, toasty, got heat on. I got a heating pad under my feet. How are you?
Doing fantastic, but I was afraid that you were going to be a radioactive isotope by now.
It was close. I saw almost like SWAT teams like out in the perimeter when I was on the plane, and I saw them like spooling up the hovercraft because it was close. I was about an hour away from running over the limit.
And so the craft was already in visual range.
It was poised. It was poised to attack. Like you see a cat, like it gets, you know, like scrunches up on its haunches right before it's about to pounce on something.
So, well, this is partially tongue in cheek and partially serious, because don't mean to make light of it, but it is a little bit of on the paranoid side to think that they have so much interest in you that they're tracking your every moment to that extreme, but yes, it could be serious business in the right circumstances. So,
and for clarity, it is my understanding that I can go to Pennsylvania for up to 1 week, up to 30 days inside of a calendar year. That is my understanding.
I have not researched that law in Pennsylvania, but I would trust that you have done your research, being that it's important to you, and if you're not required to register, I would not register just for the sake of saying that I do more than I have to.
But like, let's dig into this for just a second. The first time I went up there when I was first released, and I was told to go to like the state police barracks, because that's what they're like, you know, whatever, that's their sheriff's office is up there. And I go in there, and it's a holiday weekend, 4th of July. Like nobody was in the office, and you know, skeleton crew. And I was like, hey, I'm on probation, and my PO says I got to have this thing signed. He goes, I'm not signing that. I said, why not? He goes, you don't have to have this signed. I said, you're really going to put me in an awkward position, because those people tell me I need to have it signed. You people say I don't. And he eventually signed it for me, a travel permit for probation. But he was saying I did not need it. And he even called like their attorneys or something like that. And they said, yeah, if you're there for less than 7 days, you do not have to mess with that.
That sounds legit to me, and I tell people that all you're doing when you go register, and clearly you're not required to, if there's an absolute clear obligation where it's not even debatable, if it says, after it describes everything that triggers registration, and then if they say, or if you're physically present more than X number of hours, that's one thing. But if it has just grown up through practice that people say, well, since you have to register within 3 days of establishing a residence here, because you have to register within 3 days of becoming a student here, or you have to register within 72 hours of becoming employed here, of course you have to register within 72 hours of being present. It doesn't say that.
Right.
But when it says it unequivocally, then I understand a little bit more of the paranoia. But again, they're still not going to know if you're there 49 hours, if it's 48. They're not tracking you to that degree unless you're somebody who's a whole lot more important than most everybody that's listening to this podcast.
Which actually probably is a halfway decent segue, because the first couple articles are about using technology to monitor people. And the first one is the faulty technology behind ankle monitors. This first one comes from Vox.com, and they have a podcast called Recode, which is a technology focused podcast. And they just like, maybe you're inside your house and you don't have a good GPS signal, because, you know, signals don't do well bouncing around corners. Yeah, maybe you don't know that, Larry. And sometimes they don't necessarily go through solid structures such as your house. So you may have a shit signal. And now it says like you have, so like someone in the article said they have to go like walk around outside to get a signal. So like now they're not in violation anymore. So pretty awful way to have your freedom be in jeopardy at such a on a thin thread that could screw you up easily if the GPS thing fails.
Well, I come at it from less from the tech than I do from the appropriateness of the use. I'm no tech expert. I know that there are problems. I've heard from enough clients who've had issues with the battery power not lasting a sufficient amount of time, with the signal constantly being lost and them having to lose time from their productive day to go outside and reestablish communication with satellite. I've heard all those horror stories, and I don't know how to remedy those. But what I do know how to remedy is the appropriate usage of GPS. And it has become so widespread. And I even take issue with the beginning of the article where it says that that electronic monitoring within the criminal justice isn't widespread. And then they talk about how it has increased 100-something percent and 136% in just 10 years. Yeah. And then they talk about it. As of 2015, there was like 125,000 people on the thing, and don't tell how many are on 4 years later. My beef is with the inappropriate application and the cost of the device. A, we're supposedly saving money. That's what people that make these things say. We're going to save a whole bunch of money because it's cheaper than having the person in custody. Well, if that be the case, then why do we have to assess that cost to the person? Because if those were people who were truly going to be in custody, but not for the GPS, we should be ecstatic that we're not having to foot the custody bill, and we should be delighted to pay for the GPS. So that debunks the theory there. So what you've actually done is you've increased the universe of people who are under correctional monitoring with technology. And these people, by and large, wouldn't have been in custody anyway. They're applied so widespread to people who are on pretrial detention as a condition of your release through these brilliant bail reform movements we're having around the country. So this is, well, you'll be subject to GPS monitoring. You'll be subject to all these conditions. And then the probation systems are using them so indiscriminately, which there are lawsuits beginning to rein that in, where they're just putting them on everybody who has a particular type of an offense. That's my beef with it, because I'm no tech expert. I'm just able to see that they're overused, they're inappropriately used, and they could be a delightful tool if they were properly used.
I remember... So I got stationed at a little the local county jail, and they shipped me off to some sort of private holding facility after my sentence before I got shipped off to diagnostics. And I overheard a couple of them knuckleheads talking about, oh, hey, we're from this group, and well, how much do you guys charge? And I swear I remember hearing them say that they were charging the county $90 a day to house the people. And the GPS stuff, I think in the article, says it costs about $300 a month. I'm pretty sure $90 a day is more expensive than $300 a month.
Well, that's my point. If we are truly saving money, then there would be no reason. You should give the person a bonus for having the GPS because we're not having to spend the 90. Yes. If you're a true conservative, like most of our people say they are, then you would be so delighted that you're not spending 90 that you would give them the GPS for free and you'd give them a $20 a day bonus to have the damn thing.
I really thought you were going to say you people. If you people are predominantly conservative out there, though. I get a kick out of that expression there.
So I said something like that last week about Texas, about them being conservatives. But if you truly are conservative, and why I say that's because the conservatives are the hard-nosed ones who want to charge everybody for everything. They say, well, by golly, them taxpayers out there working, paying the taxes, they don't want to pay for these people's fancy GPS monitors. They ought to have to pay for that themselves. Well, if you truly do believe in saving taxpayer money, you would go back and tell those taxpayers, you're wrong.
Yeah,
you're wrong. We're going to cut the jail population dramatically, which is going to save a bunch of money. And I truly am a fiscal conservative. So therefore, I'm actually doing you a favor, Madam Taxpayer. That's what you would say if you're a true conservative.
I agree. That seems to be like if that were the mindset. And then we would have people producing taxes, working, keeping the economy moving and all that stuff. If they were out, even if they're on some kind of monitor, then you would keep productivity up in the economy because those people have to go buy groceries and all those things. That would be great instead of having them stuck behind the walls.
Well, I like just below the reset button where it says attack behind the podcast, where the recording is. And, I'll often hear, this is a quote from Shubha Bala, but is electronic monitoring better than jail, better jail or prison? And she says, that's the wrong question. Giving people ponies is also better than being in jail, but we don't do it because it's a useless alternative.
Yes.
So that's not the question. Is it GPS better than jail? That is not the question. The question is GPS an appropriate technology to use for this offender based on their unique characteristics? And is it the best option we have in terms of dealing with this person based on the position they're in the justice system? If they're still presumed innocent, we need to make the most minimal intrusion we possibly can into their liberty and their movement. If they're pre-trial. But when they're post-trial, then we need to decide if the GPS will assist us with that particular offender's characteristics, not just because it makes us feel good to humiliate the person and strap the thing on and tell them you owe us $300 a month, which is what happens.
And remember we talked about the one where it like would beep, beep, beep and start talking to them?
Well, that was mentioned in this article here about how the person got kicked out of class because the thing was so disruptive.
Well, and then, let's tackle this other article. It says, why is my city monitoring me? This is from Law 360. This individual, how did he come about being interested? He noticed that the cameras were up and he did some sort of, not quite like a FOIA request, but he has to have the records to know how much information they had on him. And he got 80 pages of documents showing him at various locations around town. And he's like, why are you guys monitoring me? I'm not any sort of criminal. I don't have a felony record. It feels right to, we've talked about like traffic cameras and red light cameras before privately. It seems like that's a decent idea to capture that if it's not in some sort of revenue motivated thing, but I know what it is. But people run red lights and people get, you know, T-boned or whatever. So they should only have the data long enough to evaluate whether the person ran the red light. But this is like straight up 1984 surveillance for a long period of time where they could totally track your movements across the city and whatnot.
Well, therein lies the question. The problem with this, as the technologies evolve, the laws do not evolve fast enough with them. The average lawmaker who goes to Atlanta or Little Rock or to Carson City or wherever, they're not thinking about this. They're going about their daily life, and the fact that their license plate's been scanned 265 times in the last 3 months is of no concern to them, because they don't visualize how it could be misused. They don't realize at the time, because they're not thinking those terms, that depending on where their car was spotted at, over what course of period of time, what it might could be made to look like, and who's going to have access to this information? Is it going to be sold commercially? Because cities like to raise revenue from every source they can so they can keep the taxes low. That makes voters happy. So they don't know what's going to happen with this information. And it's only when the information is used in a way that's detrimental, when it's sold to some private purveyor who misuses it, or even to a public source. But this is where the laws can't possibly keep up with the technology. So the license plate readers have been out for a number of years and been readily available and been in use for a number of years. So when you capture these images, what do you do with them? Do you rely on the police department to figure out what to do with them, how to use them, who has access to them, how long they store them? No, you need laws. And therein lies the problem. No one's thinking about this stuff now. This man's thought about it. And he's found himself on the recorded. How many times does this article say?
This is 80 pages 80 of pages. Documents. You know, I can only imagine at like an 8-point font. I mean, that's at least hundreds, if not a handful of thousands of entries.
So again, now if you go to the legislature and you say, I want to pass a bill, and you find a lawmaker to sponsor this, the police industrial complex is going to come in and say, oh, not so fast. We need this for legitimate law enforcement. I mean, we don't do anything. We have the purest of wind-driven snow intentions, and we store this safely and securely. And only if something happens in that area would we ever go and retrieve the license, and we would totally disregard. I mean, we wouldn't try to blackmail anybody or cause anybody to harm. I mean, that's what they would say. And they would scare the bejeebers out of the lawmakers in saying that this would hamper their crime-fighting efforts. So then you'll have to end up going to court. And then we'll have we'll have the Scalia model have to come in and figure out what is your expectation of privacy when you're in public. Well, we've never really had an expectation of privacy when you're in public, because you're presumed when you're out in public that you expect people to see you. But do you expect devices that are hundreds of feet in the air to see you? Do you expect that not only the visual, but do you expect to be, have 80 pages of stuff recorded about you? So what would the interpretation be about your right to privacy when you're out on a public thoroughfare being recorded through 80 pages of what's the constitutional issue here? How will the courts resolve this when cases like this go to court? We'll have to wait and see.
But don't we need to keep this information, because if you people get into an accident and we need to go back and see how many times you broke traffic laws, we need to prove that you have a history of unsafe driving.
Well, of course you don't get to do that. You don't get to use the other.
But wouldn't the law enforcement people get to use it potentially?
Well, they wouldn't be able to use it against you for causing that accident, even if you did have a history of unsafe driving.
Maybe the city would sell the data to the insurance companies and.
Well, that's my fear is yeah. we don't know where this, but like I'm saying, the lawmakers would have never have thought about that when they're thinking about funding public education K-12 and higher education, the university system, and public health and roads and senior citizen centers and on and on and on, the things that the state government, no one's thinking about, well, what about these cameras in Coral Gables that are recording people? That would never enter anyone's mind. Yeah. It would never be on their radar. So therefore, no one's ever thought about it.
until you got this guy who apparently he has means to bring in, to do the information, to get it and put together the pieces of the puzzle. Has some sort of level of awareness of his constitutionally protected right to some level of expectation of privacy, even when you're in the public square, that he shouldn't be surveilled.
Well, that's what the ACLU said. We're deeply concerned about this technology because it's feeding into absolutely gigantic databases filled with billions of private details, charting out people's movements, associations, patterns of life, in ways that are extraordinarily revealing, said Nathan Wessler, a staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union.
So what do we do, Larry?
Without strong safeguards, including judicial oversight and retention limitations and other protections, these databases threaten to give government agencies and private corporations incredible power to know many of our most sensitive secrets, he added.
So, yes. But what do we do as the lobbyist, as the concerned citizen talking to our legislators and all that stuff? What do we do?
We have to position this in a way they can understand it, kind of like the Supreme Court was forced to understand about the incident to arrest doctrine with the cell phone. They always had granted a full search as an incident to a lawful arrest of your vehicle and your person, but they drew the line at the cell phone because they realized that there was so much about you that was on your cell phone that would not have come to bear. Most people didn't carry file cabinets full of, and trunks full of information around in their cars prior to the cell phone. But so we're going to have conversations with our lawmakers and break it down to a level that they can understand an issue that they have never thought about and would have had no reason to thought about. If you're going about your normal life, the fact that your license plate's being scanned is of no concern to the average person. I ain't doing nothing wrong. Why would I care?
I totally understand that. I remember my mom forever ago. She would like, well, if you don't have anything to hide, blah, blah, blah. Like, that's a hard argument to get out of. That one is.
Well, I mean, you can take it to even further ridiculous extremes about suppose you're happily married and you're a family person, and you're upstanding in the community, and you hold a high public office, and you have a weekly rendezvous at a hotel room, and you spend a few hours, and the police have surveillance cameras that are reading the license plate numbers, and they have you documented at that hotel week in, week out, week in, week out. Do you think that the police would have more power over you to persuade your votes, or do you think they'd have less power if they brought the information to you and said that, gee, as we've been researching our files, we see that you're at this hotel on a regular basis as a married man? There's just so much potential for abuse with this that you could go on and on with imagining. And yes, there are people out there who would do that. I know 99.8725% of the police are just upstanding, wonderful people. But there are people out there who misuse their powers as police officers, including running personal checks for the NCIC, doing investigative, private investigative work for people for money, using police resources. There is that sliver of a percentage of people out there.
Did you hear about Uber? This is several years ago. Did you hear about Uber? They have a command center, and they can see at the time, like, they could go into quote unquote like God mode, and they could see where all of the drivers are, and they could also see where all of their passengers were. So you could then like target, knowing that Bill Gates is riding an Uber in Phoenix or something like that, and you would know where he is. And there's your abuse of power right there.
So, but yeah, we're going to have to explain it to our lawmakers in a way that they can relate to. And then we're going to have to overcome a lot of police and the license plate manufacturer readers' opposition, because the sky would be falling as far as they're concerned, because if they can't sell these things, that's not good for their business.
Yeah. And what is the natural organization that is protecting that? Is that the ACLU? Or is that just totally us, the concerned citizens, that are telling our lawmakers, hey, you guys got to be careful of this?
It's primarily, I think, the ACLU. I don't think the average citizens, this is not on their radar.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so either.
So it
is getting more so because everyone's putting cameras up. Ring video doorbells is, that's just going to be, there's cameras everywhere all the time for all things by private and public entities.
But you're not thinking about your license plate being read and stored in a searchable database. A video that's not searchable is different than these ALPRs. They are scannable. The scans are searchable.
Yes.
So they're actually able to retrieve who the car belongs to without a lot of effort. And it says that 66% of large law enforcement agencies used those readers by 2016. We would certainly qualify as a large law enforcement agency here.
And they drive around in their cars, and as they have the cameras on their cars, and as they drive around, they're potentially doing scans of just everyone on the road as they pass by, potentially looking for a stolen vehicle. Okay, great, you broke the law. You shouldn't have broken the law. But that doesn't mean that I, not committing any sort of crime at all, should have any record of my whereabouts.
So, yeah, they read frontwards and backwards now.
Correct. Yep, yep, yep.
So,
thanks, machine learning, to figure out how to read letters, assholes. Let's move over to, this is Pittsburgh's NPR news station. Pennsylvania creates criminal offense of sexual extortion. I'm not really sure I understand how it is a crime to, where was it? Where it said, so I get if I say, hey, Larry, if you don't do these sexual things for me, then I'm going to release the pictures, whatever. Where did it go? Darn it. It listed like the three or four different kinds of crimes that they were. It says simulating a sex act in the second to last paragraph. It says the law defines sexual extortion as using a threat of some type of coerce of some kind of threat to coerce a victim into a sex act. Simulating a sex act. I don't understand that one. Undress or making a video or image of it. I totally don't get those final points of what would be criminal.
Well, I had some struggle with it myself. It's a very limited article, but I always ask myself, let me show you how I think in terms of what I see when I read an article like this. When I see who supported it, the legislation was signed by Governor Wolf. Takes effect in 2 months. It was had the backing of the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape and the Pennsylvania District Attorneys Association. Those are not typically groups that we ally with. So that
shocker so, there. So that right? gives, but that's interesting. Okay,
that gives me a very high degree of dubiosity when I read that, because that is the industrial complex at work. So then I ask myself when I see the sponsors, I ask myself, is this something where there would be adequate prosecutorial tools already in place? And usually there are. I think that already it's against the law in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, maybe not since Sandusky, but I think it's already against the law for you to have a minor do the naughty, naughty simulated so that you can capture it. So if I tell a 16-year-old prior to this, that I'd like to see you. If you don't let me see you, your junk, I'm going to reveal the secret about you. I happen to think that's already against the law.
Yeah. I mean, blackmail is already illegal, correct?
I think so.
I mean, isn't there kind of a big case going on at the federal level? There's a big accusation going on blackmail or extortion. Anyway, that's a completely different conversation.
But so this new law is a third degree felony, which is punishable by up to 7 years in prison if the victim is under 18 or if the perpetrator has shown a pattern of engaging in sexual extortion. So they got you as a third degree of felony if you have a pattern. I don't know what constitutes a pattern because I haven't read the legislation. But if the victim's under 18, but the under 18 are already protected. So what comes to my mind right away was that Representative Ted Nesbitt, Republican of Mercer, probably needed to feel good in an upcoming election campaign. And this probably wasn't necessary.
So they've made something that was already illegal, illegaler.
This penalty may be harsher than what they could have already done, which is what we had with our, we already had a crime here of enticement of a child. But they insisted about 2007 that we needed to have the crime called electronic solicitation of a child. Enticement of a child would have applied if you were in a car or in a pool hall or any place where a minor, where you tried to entice them to go to a private place with you for sinister purposes that would constitute an unlawful sex act. Well, the electronic solicitation was never needed because whether you were in the pool hall or whether you were on the internet to entice a minor under 16 years of age to meet you in a secluded place for an immoral purpose was already unlawful. Yeah. They could have prosecuted under that statute. The only problem is that's only a misdemeanor. So the enticement of a child is a fourth degree felony. And then if you actually show up for a meeting, it's a third degree felony. So what they've done is made a new crime that's more severe. I think that the prosecutorial tools were already there to take care of this. And I would have needed to have been convinced otherwise before I could have supported this. But this is the type of thing you can't vote against. If you want your political career to survive, if you vote against something like this, you're going to be vilified. And I just about bet you it passed unanimously. It would be politically disastrous to vote against the coalition of rapes, the victims, the district attorneys, and protecting children. That's a suicidal move, and very few people would do that.
This next one comes from Vox, and it's private prisons face an uncertain future as states turn their backs on the industry. I didn't really get the impression that that's the, like, I know that the Obama Justice Department had put forth that they were at least going to reduce, like, they were canceling contracts, whatever, and then Trump turns around and, like, hey, let's fire that whole engine back up on full blast. That my understanding was that private prisons weren't struggling even in this current climate. Did I misread something?
At the federal level, they're not. But a lot of states, like my state, we have, I think we still have the highest percent of our prisons beds under private ownership and management. At the state level, the states are having a second thought. But I don't understand it. I mean, I'm looking at this article, and this is just a bunch of liberals trying to destroy. They're trying to destroy the entrepreneurship that made this country great. These companies have come in and invested hundreds of millions of dollars in building facilities and providing a service to the taxpayers to save them from having to use their capital outlay. And then you guys are just constantly trying to tear down the capitalist system. I mean, you must just hate America and everything about this country.
Let me put on the serious hat for a minute. I'm 100% with you. I can appreciate the notion that the private sector would be interested in reducing inefficiency so that they can maximize profit. But the problem with this model is who the product is. Like, where are they going to gain any level of efficiencies? And the two most expensive places are going to be human resources. So, like, their benefits package and their pay to their employees. The second thing is the thing that they're responsible for. And that is, how much toilet paper do you get? How are you going to do the medical for the people? What kind of food are you going to feed? And how much food? I mean, they are micromanaging that stuff down to the utmost finite detail. And the inmates are the ones that suffer. And I came to the conclusion, why I was housed in one of those establishments, that this is the worst idea ever, is to have private companies controlling the welfare of human beings and they are driven by cost and maximizing their cost for their shareholders. It is the worst idea. It should be totally on the backs of the state and the citizenry to take care of these people within the guidelines or whatever we determine those guidelines are, but it should not be done by private companies. No way.
I'm appalled. Everybody knows that's listening to this podcast that private companies have the utmost concern for their customers, that they are not. I mean, how long would they be in business if prisoners were going malnourished and having to be carried out on stretchers? And the problem with state prisons is that we have too much fluff. You read this article. The first thing the person noticed when they went to a state prison was that there would just be an abundance of staff compared to what they had in the private. I mean, that's unnecessary fluff, and it's inefficient. And I don't understand how that you would be so opposed to the capitalist system. You're trying to tear this country down. We need to be trying to build it up. We need more capitalism.
And everyone's 401k plan has these two companies in them. So, you know, you're driving dollars into people's 401k plans by how many people we have incarcerated. It's a very, very false incentive system. It is a really, really misaligned incentive system.
Well, now
Mike and Chess says Make America Great Again. Yeah, that's a great idea there, Mike.
So on a serious note, this is an example of, even if you are a big believer in the private enterprise system, there are things that that ought not be done privately. And this is probably one we should be treading very carefully on the private incarceration, because we don't want the perverse incentives of keeping people, which we have in our state with about 42, 43% of our prison beds under private management. They have no incentive to work on parole plans, because what happens when they parole a person? Where does that per diem go?
Right. Well, they meet, you know, their model is based on some 90-95% occupancy rate, you know, like a hotel would be trying to consider it. And their model breaks down if they fall below that.
Well, of course, we guarantee them that they would have a minimal level of occupancy in our state. Right. I don't know what other states did. But in order, if you're at 90, I think it was 90% we guaranteed, but if they're at 92%, wouldn't they rather be at 95%?
Of course, there's
an incentive not to process people out and to help people get out. And this is really not an attractive model for privatization. And it's one of those things where, even as strongly as I do believe in the private system, where it does generally provide a pretty good balance between, I mean, we look at all the other systems, and this one works fairly well, but it doesn't work perfectly. And somehow or another, if you have any criticism of where it doesn't work so well, which is in delivery of healthcare, is another example, then somehow you're anti-American and you're trying to destroy everything about the country. And I don't understand why people feel the need to say that you hate the country because you recognize that there's some defects within the country that could be done better and improved upon. I just don't get that.
Did I lose my train of thought? This would be, and I know I'm going to get throw all the tomatoes that you want at me through the chat window if you want to, but this model could work if there were regulations in place to guarantee some minimum level of coverage, care, you know, pick your word, for the amount of food to be given, the amount of staff to have in place, and then it's on them. If they can't meet the staff, they have to then do whatever they have to do to get staff. Does that mean they have to raise wages by $50 or a dollar per hour to get people to be willing to go into these environments? It's the only, that would be, I think, I'm sure there's other ways. That would be one of the ways to make sure that there's some sort of standard of care, that they're not just totally driven by the dollar bill.
Well, and those standards already exist. There was one of my liberal rags that I read about the Marshal Service and about the invisible. They contract with hundreds and hundreds of local jails around the country, and about supposedly the tough standards they had, and they showed how the inspections rarely fail any institution. We have those standards here that you're talking about, but the problem is we don't have any bed space to put these people.
Yeah,
our facilities are running right at capacity, just shy of capacity. So if you close down a 1,400 person prison because they're not meeting their standards, what do you do with 1,400 people?
Yes.
So it's a hollow threat. But yes, we have minimum caloric intake. We have minimum staffing ratios. They don't fulfill the ratios that they said, well, we just can't hire enough people. And So what do you do? I mean, would you cut? It's easier to cut recreation. It's easier to cut out time than it is. There's some things that are just not easy to cut. So the program component is what goes before security. I mean, we have to have institutional security. Correct. So you're going to cut programs.
Mike in chat says that we should allow the inmates to have muskets and allow them to hunt. It would save money on food.
Well, I think he might be onto something. I think these people ought to work from sun up to sundown in grueling conditions. We need to make all the prisons like Parchman, Mississippi.
Right, except for 95% of people getting out of prison. What are they going to do when they get out? That doesn't really provide them with a lot of modern-day economy skill sets for them to have gainful employment. They'll have strong backs and calluses on their hands.
I think Parchment may have closed. I'm not sure. But anyway,
I've never heard of it.
You haven't heard of Parchment?
No, I haven't. I've heard of Parchment paper.
Yeah, there's been picture shows made about that place.
Okay. Nope, never heard of it.
So you people must be under a rock.
That's very possible. Over on BuzzFeed News, we have an opinion piece that says, I was in jail for 7 years for a crime I didn't commit. I'm owed more than my freedom. It's not enough to free the innocent. We must rebuild their lives that are shattered by a broken system. We have another article similar to this one, too, coming up. But this individual spent a bunch of time in prison for a crime that he was eventually acquitted or exonerated from. What's the word I'm looking for there? Exonerated. And the article goes through and profiles that we put people behind these cages and they have no resources. They have no ability to fend for themselves. And then we're like, whoops, I messed up. Oh, hey, we're going to open up the doors. Hey, good luck. And they pat them on the butt and send them on their way. Good game.
And why is that a problem?
It's not a problem. Let's move right on over to the next article. But I was listening to a podcast and I was going to bring it up for the show tonight. I just ran out of time, but it's from this podcast I listened to called Today Explained. And they were talking about victims advocates and, you know, survivors and the child abuse stuff that's going on in the Catholic Church. That's pretty much where the article centered around. And I think our perception, and I'm pointing at myself as if anybody can see me, our perception is that when someone has, they say that they were abused, we are inclined to believe them, and I can accept that. But that also then says when they point the finger at the individual, we assume that they're guilty and they should be put away for the rest of their life. And if we then take the leap that they would be convicted in court, all of those things, if we just make those assumptions, that's fair. But if we get it wrong, that person sits behind bars for something that they did not do. And I don't think that we should just jump to the conclusion that they deserve to spend all of that time in prison to try and figure out how to get themselves out if they have some level of ability to prove that they didn't do it. It's a terrible thing.
It is, and this article illuminates that wrongful convictions are all too common. Since 1989, more than 2,515 people have been exonerated after proving their innocence. Now remember, you're in prison usually with no resources. The public systems have very little to offer you in post-conviction. You end up trying to do all this stuff pro se, and you reach out to the Innocence Project, and they have like one attorney trying to handle 400 requests
Correct.
Of people who say they're innocent. But it says since then, innocent people have lost over 22,315 years of their lives, and taxpayers have spent $4.12 billion incarcerating them. Now, if you're a conservative, as you say you are, and you want to be frugal with government spending, this should appall you that you're spending all this money incarcerating people. If you'd used the $4.12 billion for indigent defense, perhaps some of these people wouldn't have gotten convicted on the front side. And you would not have, and you wouldn't potentially owe them $80,000 a year like Texas pays for wrongful incarceration.
I don't even know that that's enough money, Larry. I mean, you could potentially have earned so much more money than that. It's not, you can't expect them to be just minimum wage employees.
Well, $80,000 is hardly minimum wage, but $7.25 an hour. But at least Texas, to their credit, they do give you something. This is talking about where people get nothing. They're told good luck, and they're talking about people that have been in prison for decades and who don't have says the three men will leave prison after 36 years with a paper bag of possessions from when they were 16 years old.
Yeah, and then it goes on to say they will be broke without any job prospects, technical skills, credit, education, or even a job history to rely on. It's ridiculous.
And again, I think a true conservative would say, we got it wrong. We wasted a bunch of money incarcerating these people. And now I want to try to help this person rebuild their life for the time they have left, because I want to get some tax money out of them. We spent $4.12 billion on them. And I'd be happy to spend a little bit more to try to get them back on their feet, because I would rather them be paying taxes than consuming services. But that's not the mindset.
I was trying to develop a thought while you were talking, and I don't know if I can complete it that quickly. When this happens, you end up like the survivor, the victim didn't get justice. The person that incorrectly went to prison didn't get justice. And the person that committed the crime didn't get justice either. But the taxpayers also got kind of railroaded too, with the $4 billion spent in incarcerating the wrong people.
That is correct. And that's the sad travesty about this, because the legal system should always want, to the extent human possibly, to never incarcerate a person unless they've got it right. Because if we incarcerate a person just to close a case, the culprit is still on the loose, which means more victimization. You should never want an innocent person to be incarcerated.
So over at ProPublica, 30 years of jailhouse snitch scandals. This seems also really terrible to me that we would rely, we're going back to the incentive idea that I was just talking about with the private prisons. If there's somebody that is in prison and he is going to potentially receive some sort of perk, some sort of benefit for snitching on someone else, the person has all kinds of incentives to make up stories, to at least embellish stories about the person that they're hanging out in their cell, or, you know, somewhere in the common area. I forgot what it's called at this point, the day room. And so they almost fabricate stories to the point where somebody gets convicted of a crime, and then, this informant, this jailhouse snitch didn't necessarily come forward with the most accurate of information. So here we are, I guess, sort of similar to the previous article about people being locked up for things that they didn't commit. And here we have jailhouse snitches being—they're almost on like the dole of the prison system or the DA to pass along information to get people convicted.
I have this conversation with lawmakers from time to time. Every time we have a vacancy at the corrections department for a high level of management, particularly the secretary, but even the top administrators, I tell them, if there's one question you would want to ask them about inmate care, is what's your feeling about a snitch system? And if they can't answer the question, they're not fit to be in administration. And running a snitch based system, which prisons all too commonly do, is a very dangerous thing to do. And anybody who was going to, if I were in a position to appoint a corrections secretary, if you favor a snitch system, you would not be on my short list of candidates.
Can you go back? Like you go talk to lawmakers and say, do you believe in this model? And some say yes.
Well, no, lawmakers, it's just when I'm having a freestyle chat about what's wrong with the corrections system, who we'd want to be leading the corrections department, certain qualities you're looking for. And one is how they feel about inmate care, because inmate care and reintegration is very important. If they can't talk about reintegration and inmate care, and part of inmate care is not running a prison-based snitch system. Law enforcement has their own snitch system where they bring cases against people based on snitch. But I had just drifted over to the jailhouse snitch themselves. That I tell lawmakers every chance I get that if the New Mexico Department of Corrections is running a snitch system, you're putting everybody in danger.
Yeah.
There should be no rewarding of snitches by the administration. Now, that sounds contrary to what the average person would want to believe, because they would say, well, of course we'd want snitches because we want to know what's going on. And you are correct. You do want to know what's going on when you're running a prison, but you want to know what's actually going on, not made up stuff.
Here's backwards.
So, and you get a lot of it's like torture. Torture will actually get a lot of confessions.
Yeah, they might not be accurate. Torture might not be real.
Yes, absolutely. You could torture someone till they tell you that someone did something that they didn't do. They may admit something they didn't do just to stop the torture, but they may also confess that someone else did something, and you put that person in jeopardy. So a snitch system is not a safe way to run a corrections department. So if I'm ever conversing about what's a priority for me for corrections administration, that generally comes up about how do they feel about jailhouse snitches. They have no business running a system where they encourage snitching. It's going to happen even if you don't encourage it. People are going to intuitively want to gain favors, and they're going to rat out stuff, and they're going to approach staff members with stuff. But they should not be rewarded for doing it. That's what I mean by encouraging it.
Who do you think drives that bus, though? Is it the warden? Is it just like somebody that's over a housing unit? Is it the DA that's over trying to incentivize someone being a snitch?
Well, it's all of the above. The prison administration, if benefits flow, if you hand me a sliver of paper and I'm a guard and benefit flows to you, if you all of a sudden get some special privilege because of that, what was on that piece of paper, that's not a system. I can't stop you from handing me the piece of paper if you do that. But what I can do is not reward you for giving it to me.
Right.
And that's what I'm saying. I don't believe in rewarding snitches at all because it's a dangerous model.
Yeah, sure. I'm just trying to think of who, like, I mean, the snitch could just be an entrepreneur, you know, an enterprising individual trying to collect information to then build up to get the favor. Or is it being driven from the top down? The DA calls in someone who's, you know, gets Jeffrey Epstein, like they get his cellmate come over to the office, feed him a big steak. It's like, hey, we want you to give us all the dirt on Epstein.
I think,
and send him back to the dorm.
I think it's all the above.
That's highly unethical.
I think cops drive it. I think prison administrators drive it. And I think the inmates themselves drive it. But if you don't reward it, they will stop doing it. If you hand one of our officers a note 3 weeks in a row and you get no special trip to the warden's office, yeah. You get no special trip to you get no extra food on your tray. You get no extra anything. You're going to pretty soon stop doing it.
Definitely sounds fair on that one.
And that's what I mean by the prisons should not reward that.
Yeah.
Should they investigate it? Yes. Should they try to determine if it's credible? Yes. That's your job, to keep the prison safe. You shouldn't just throw it in the trash can. But you shouldn't reward the person for getting your information. But yes, you would take the information and you'd look into it and see if there's any validity to it. If there's a jailbreak being plotted, of course you'd want to look into that. There'd be certain people you wouldn't want to have break out of jail. There's some people who actually do belong in there.
You put this thing in here. I'm going to say you people, abajournal.com. And this is, I'm going to let you set this up. So what goes on in the mind of a sentencing judge? Tell me what you want to do with this one.
Well, it was a podcast, and I listened to a big part of it, not all of it, but I listened to a big part of it, and I found it intriguing when the federal judge was talking about sentencing and the factors. And since I'm so dead set against mandatory minimums, when the legislative branch ties the judiciary's hands, I find it appalling, and I just wanted to particularly highlight that segment of the interview with the judge, what he felt when he was sitting people away from mandatory minimums, and then it crosses over into our issue about possession of child porn images.
And so we have roughly a 3-minute clip that I'm going to play. Here we go.
Also, you talk about mandatory minimums and the three strikes law, and kind of how a judge is supposed to navigate those. Could you kind of talk about those and what you write about in the book?
So that's the flip side of what I just told you about, mm-hmm. where the judge has all this discretion, but there are large areas of the law where we don't have discretion, and we just message it, girls and boys. And one, of course, is mandatory minimums. So Congress really has control over us, because in respect to any given crime that it establishes as a crime that requires sentencing. It can say the sentence should be a mandatory minimum. It has the discretion to decide how to indict somebody. So if they think that the case is one where they should indict somebody that would carry a mandatory minimum, they make that decision. If they think that the case should not be a mandatory minimum case, then they can charge differently. Once again, the judge is on the receiving line. When I sentence somebody that has a mandatory minimum, I tell the defendant, I'm just the messenger boy. The government has sentenced you, and I'm just delivering their decision to you. Now, there are times, of course, when you could sentence somebody in excess of the mandatory minimum, but they're relatively few because the mandatory minimums are pretty high and pretty harsh by and large.
I have a question. You know, three co-equal branches of government, and the legislators then tie the hands of the judicial branch by making them have mandatory minimums. Why don't the legislators... why don't they just leave it in the hands of the judges?
Well, that's what we used to do decades ago. But what was noticeably present prior to the Sentencing Reform Act of 1984 was there was such a disparity in the outcomes for the criminal. And I'm talking about the federal system when I talk about the Sentencing Reform Act that Congress passed in 1984 and President Reagan signed. You take a convicted person in San Francisco of the same federal crime, and then you took that same crime and took a federal district judge in Alabama, and you had a heck of a lot more people being probated in San Francisco than you did in Alabama. And since we're the United States of America, it was thought that that wasn't fair because we had such a disparity. And prior to 1984, about half of the federal defendants got probation. It's probably less than 10% now. I think we covered it on a podcast one time, but it's down dramatically. But that was what used to happen. But the backlash from the people is, why are these people, they're either getting no prison time at all, or they're getting sent to Club Fed. So the politicians are a reflection. I keep telling people on this podcast over and over again, our political decisions are a reflection of us. We wanted harsh sentencing, and we demanded what we got. Now, of course, when your family member gets caught up in a mandatory minimum, then it's all of a sudden that conservative mom who calls me and says, my poor little hijito, he got 10 years, and all he did was have some images. And I said, yes, ma'am, that's correct. That's what he got. That's the mandatory minimum. Well, that just ain't right. And I said, well, but that's what you supported through your congressional representation years ago. Oh, I did? Yes. You remember when we were having the crackdown on crime? And you remember back when we were making things tougher on criminals? You remember how that sounded so good? You remember you were for all that until it happened to you. And they sheepishly finally admit, yes, I was for all of this until it happened to me. I'd like to point out one other thing about this. Toward the end of it, he talked about the charging and the indictment process. This is something that has changed from the previous administration to what we have now. The Obama administration had recognized that you could control the trajectory of how much time people received by not indicting with every tool that you have and not using the toughest charging. You can charge people under statutes that will trigger a minimum. And this isn't Larry saying it. This is the federal judge saying it. Or you can charge them in an alternative way, and you don't have to seek enhancements. This administration has said, charge people with the maximum possible charge you can come up with and seek the maximum penalties. This is not me saying that. This is the administration saying it. So I'm pointing out that the federal judge has also said the same thing, and he's probably more credible than me, that by how you charge a person has a direct impact on how long they're in prison.
And that comes down to essentially the DA, correct?
Well, in the case of the U.S. government, it'd be the U.S. Attorney General and the Department
fair
of
enough,
Justice.
Fair enough.
And all the assistant U.S. attorneys around the country that answer to, in this case, Mr. Barr. but previously to Mr. Sessions. But immediately upon this administration taking office, they issued within 3 months a directive to seek the maximum penalties and to charge the maximum crimes. This is not Larry saying that this is what they did. And so that's why I have a deep disagreement with this administration on criminal justice. I give them credit for pushing the first step to the finish line. It was a watered-down version of first step that had to be dramatically worked down from what the bipartisan compromise had been because of the opposition of 6 conservative senators led by Tom Cotton from Arkansas. But nonetheless, this administration helped push it to the finish line. So I give them credit for that. I also criticize them for what I don't agree with them and seeking maximum penalties. I don't agree with them, so I feel free to criticize them. I give them credit where credit is due. And they get credit and they get criticism because they deserve credit for one thing and they deserve criticism for the other.
I mean, I'm pretty sure, like, just for example, we can go back to use the little hobbit Skippy with the big ears, Jeff Sessions. He was like adamant, like, drugs are just bad. Drugs are bad, okay? But we have, I don't know, does the United States have like an 80%, 70% support of legalization of marijuana? And he's still going to stand up there and go, it's bad and we shouldn't do it. But the United States, by an overwhelming majority, supports it. And I'm just using that as one very small example of this.
And well, you see state after state taking the lead on that because we can't get anything through the federal. It's a lot harder to pass anything through Congress because of the procedural hurdles. A minority can stop something in the Senate.
Yes, of course.
But at the state level, there are more and more states that are at least doing the medical marijuana. And how many states are doing recreational marijuana? I think our state's probably going to join either this year or the next year. We're in a 30-day session this year, so we may not be able to resolve a complex issue in a 30-day session. But I think we'll get it done before the end of this governor's first term.
And I've talked about this before. I'm pretty sure that just before I got out, the Georgia legislature was going over this thing. And I remember hearing some profile of a dad, and he had to go to Colorado, get drugs, and bring them back. So he's like actually doing, you know, distribution and transportation and all that stuff to get marijuana for his kid that has hundreds of seizures per day. And I just can't fathom.
That was on the podcast. We talked about that on the podcast.
God, this drives me freaking bonkers, Larry. It is so unconscionable that some legislator would be like, nope, FYP. Sorry, your kid suffers. And I'm like, you are just the worst asshole. You are the worst human on the planet to say that to a father that parents can't get their kid something that we know about.
But just ask that guy. I just about guarantee you, if I remember him, he was from Middle Georgia. I just about bet you he voted straight conservative on all this stuff because he had the bigger picture to look at, is what they always say. They think that we don't look at the bigger picture. They think that somehow or other we only look at a narrow picture. But I just about bet that he was the conservative law and order type that all of a sudden, since this impacted him, he didn't understand it. But people, they vote continuous for the wrong folks, and then they're surprised about the results. I tell people, well, I mean, you've been voting for this all this time. I don't know why you're surprised. This is what they ran on. This is what they promised you they would do.
He's like, I will be the law and order president. I totally get it. Now that we've run off all of our remaining listeners.
But he didn't tell any of you any lie. He told you that's what he was going to do, and he's just kept his word. In terms of seeking harsh penalties, that's what he said he was going to do.
We got what we asked for, right?
You voted for it with him telling you that.
I've said this before. There's a line in Batman, like the Dark Knight series. It's the more recent Batman stuff. And he said somewhere, I think Commissioner Gordon says, Batman isn't the hero we want. He's the hero we need, or the one that we deserve, or something like that. And that's, I just totally feel that that's where we are.
Mm-hmm.
One other thing to say on that. Because we created these problems by voting, whether that was consciously or unconsciously voting, I also then feel that then we can fix it if we can figure out how to vote better. To me, I feel it's empowering. I'm excited to hear it this way.
Well, I'm probably a little more harsh than I should be. The issues are more complicated than most people have the bandwidth to really to dig into, to understand. We operate in sound bites. And when you're campaigning on being tough, the average person's not going to look into the legislation and read 30, 40, 50 pages. They're not. All they hear is the cops say that we want to crack down on child predators. Who's going to be fundamentally against that when it's presented that way? So, of course, the average person says, of course, I'm going to go along with that. I mean, the average person, there's too many issues. If we roll back the clock to the Civil War time or even to the colonial times, the issues that the national government and even the state governments were dealing with were far fewer than they are today. We live in a very complicated society where there's so many more issues that are up, and the problems involve complexities that didn't exist just a few decades ago. If we were debating problems in 1975, the solution, we didn't have all the considerations we have now in trying to craft a solution. So it's just a different era. So the average person is just overwhelmed.
Yes.
And that's what makes it easier just to be soundbite driven. And that's what works. The person votes soundbites.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Well, let's move over to, I can't imagine that we've ever covered anything from a place called Tech Dirt, because you are you are as old as dirt and you hate tech. How's that?
That's correct.
Oregon Supreme Court shuts down pretextual traffic stops. Says cops can't ask questions unrelated to the violation. The funny thing in this article that they describe, and I think you said that we covered this before, but the cop walks up to the car. I find this to be hysterical. Every time I walk up, I ask him, "Hey, Officer Faulkner, Beaverton Police Department, do my contact with them. Do you have anything illegal in the car? Would you consent to a search for guns, drugs, knives, bombs, illegal documents, or anything like that that you're not allowed to possess?" The cop asks that walking up to the car for someone that's going 5 miles over the speed limit.
And why is that a problem?
I think this goes back to our some expectation of privacy that, hey, I pulled you over for your taillight being out. You didn't signal. You ran a stop sign. I want to know that you have bombs in the car. Doesn't that extend past some kind of Fourth Amendment unwarranted search?
Well, in this case, I do think we talked about it before. I don't think I had the decision this time. I've actually gone through and read it and highlighted, made a bunch of yellow highlights. The defendant was lawfully stopped for failing to signal a turn and a lane change. During the stop, while the defendant was searching for his registration and proof of insurance, the officer asked him about presence of drugs, guns, and requested consent to search. Well, that wasn't the reason why he pulled the person over. He didn't have any suspicion about those things. He was investigating failure to signal, and that was the extent of the investigation. And so the bunch of darn liberal do-gutters up there in the Oregon Supreme Court, they have just wrecked this officer, because when he gave the consent, he gave consent, and they did find drugs, and then he moved to suppress, and the trial court said no, and the Court of Appeals said no, that the officer was doing his job, and he appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said no, based on our doctrine of case law here, the traffic stop needs to be confined to the purpose for the stop unless new probable cause arises, and that probable cause had not yet arisen when he was asking about that. It's possible that you could open a window at a traffic stop and the plume of dope smell could be so strong that the original reason for the stop would be overshadowed by the new evidence that surfaced when that plume of dope came out the window. And at that point, you could expand the scope. But at the point, he didn't have any basis to expand the scope of the stop, but he did. So now we've messed up the Beaverton police and the officer Faulkner, and he's going to be forever traumatized when he pulls somebody over because he can't do his job. And this is just ridiculous as an example of these justices just that don't have a clue about what's going on in the real world out there. And they're turning loose a guy who had was running dope on our community so that there's no accountability. And that's just ridiculous, Andy.
How does this relate to, since this came out recently with Bloomberg running, how does this come out for like the stop and frisk stuff that was going on in New York 20 years ago? Isn't this the same?
Well, I'd say it's a pretty doggone close parallel there.
I mean, you are a human, right? And, you know, you are, you know, can I stop and frisk you just because you're on the street and I'm a cop and I do what I want because I have my rights?
That's what that cop said. But a stop and frisk is not constitutional. There's case law where a pat is pretty much acceptable, the exterior of the clothing, if there's reason to believe that there might be safety issues. But
you see a bulge of a gun, something.
Yes. But this case hinges on the officer who had no reason at all to expand the scope of his stop beyond the taillight, doing it as a matter of routine. And he admitted it. The evidence supported it because he said, that's what I do to everybody. But we had talked about last week, when does a seizure occur? So if you look at page 7 on the highlight there, it says, for purposes of an Article 1, Section 9, a seizure occurs when, one, a police officer intentionally and significantly interferes with an individual liberty, freedom, or of movement, or two, a reasonable person under the totality of the circumstances would believe that his or her liberty or freedom of movement has been significantly restricted. You remember when I said that you don't have to be cuffed for there to be a seizure and a detention?
Yeah.
Well, this is the State Supreme Court of Oregon applying the Constitution to what constitutes. If you're like those guys at Nordstrom or whatever that store was, if they felt that they couldn't leave, and a reasonable person there would not believe that they could have left that parking lot, and the police officer had intentionally and significantly interfered with their freedom of movement, that was in fact a seizure.
Right.
And that may end up being a legal action against the police, against that off duty. Here we call that chief's overtime. When you hire when you want a police officer to provide private security, you go through the police department and you pay some exorbitant rate of $75 or something an hour, and then you have a real uniformed police officer who's working off duty on chief's overtime. That's going to be a real problem for them if that guy decides that he wants to, those two guys decide they want to make an issue of it, because clearly they were seized without any justification. But back to this case, this guy gave the consent, but he was being detained. And the consent was the court didn't say it, but they interpreted it as being under duress, and that therefore his motion to suppress was granted, which means that this case is going to die.
And I'm going to put you out on a ledge here where I think you're going to be somewhat uncomfortable. But I just, can you give me your, not obviously legal, you know, you're not a lawyer, I know this, but there's the indented paragraph in the article. It says, in contrast to a person on the street who may unilaterally end an officer-citizen encounter at any time, the reality is that a motorist stopped for a traffic infraction is legally obligated to stop at an officer's direction. So if you're walking down the street and a cop says, hey, can I talk to you a minute? You can be like, FYP, and keep walking?
That would be within your purview of thing, unless the cop demands that you stop. But if a cop says, hey, I'd like to talk to you, you'd say, well, I wouldn't like to talk to you.
And you keep motoring on.
And if the cop says,
same situation happens with a cop, with a car, you are legally, and is that going to be on a state by state basis? I assume yes, but.
No, when the cop engages their emergency equipment, their overheads, you're obligated to pull over under the traffic code.
Okay. All right. Civil regulatory scheme, correct?
When you accept a privilege, the car to operate a vehicle, you agree to certain things. One's to be tested for use of alcohol, the implied consent. I think almost all states have that. And you agree that you'll abide by the rules of the road and that you will engage with an officer upon the officer asking for an engagement. But they turn all those overheads, they're requesting an engagement. Now, they have to have a reason.
to turn on those, but you're obligated to pull over. Just like when there's emergency sirens and stuff, you're supposed to pull to the right and let the, I mean, those are requirements. But when you're walking down the street, you don't have any obligation to talk to the police.
Okay. And unless he invokes his, like, hey, I'm the police and I can do what I want and I need to stop you, you are supposed to comply to some degree?
If the cop says, I'll order you to stop, you're going to be charged with willful disobey if you don't. But if a cop says, I'd like to talk to you, do you have a moment? You say, no, I actually don't have a moment. I'm going to keep going.
So Will asks, what can a law-abiding citizen do when they are stopped by an officer and they properly invoke their rights and the cop starts escalating? I think you're screwed. You have to comply. I mean, you don't have to, but you're going to end up getting body slammed.
Will, are we talking about on the street or are we talking about in a vehicle?
Yes.
Yes to which?
You broke up for just a second.
I said, are we talking about a stop by an officer when you're driving your vehicle, or are we talking about a stop by an officer when you're on foot?
I think Will, in this case, is talking about on the feetses.
So, well, if I never encourage anyone to disobey an officer if they give you a command. But if an officer says, and here's why I'm wording it, I would like to talk to you. Do you have a moment? No, I don't. If the officer says, stop, I demand that I talk to you. I'm never going to suggest a person get tased and say don't follow the officer's command, because you're inviting being tased if you're told to stop and you don't.
Yes, possibly as you're jumping into a lake or a pond.
I've heard of that.
Yeah. Foreshadowing. Sorry.
So I've heard of that, but I would never tell a person to risk the wrath of an officer for disobeying an order. But it's like when a cop says, can I search your vehicle? No, sir, you can't.
Can I search yours first, please?
that's different than saying, I'd order you out of the vehicle. I'm going to search your vehicle. That's a whole different setup. But if the officer says, would you mind giving me consent? Say, yes, I do mind, and no, I won't.
I have a feeling. I have a feeling that they would be like, well, if you have nothing to hide, why can't I search it? And you're going to be there. Sitting there on the side of the road for a while.
That's exactly what they would probably say. They would say, well, I'll tell you what we can do. We can get a warrant. And you can say, yes, you possibly can. If you can articulate the requisite level of probable cause, you can possibly get a warrant. But you know what? That's going to take you a bunch of time. And if you come up with empty-handed, you're going to look kind of foolish for getting a warrant. What's your probable cause, officer? What are you going to tell the magistrate for the probable cause? Because, you know, if you don't have the requisite probable cause, this may come back to bite you in the ass. That's what you can tell the officer. They're not going to like that very much, but that's what you could tell the officer.
Yeah.
And I don't mind sitting here all night because, officer, I've done nothing wrong. And ultimately, I think I'm going to get paid for this because you're in the wrong.
Yeah. I don't know that under the pressure of that situation, I could articulate that cleanly and come across, you know, and stand my ground and all that. I would be like, and stuttering and stammering.
Very few people would be able to go toe-to-toe. The cops have the fear of all these weapons are attached to them.
Yeah.
They've got dogs. They've got helicopters. They've got hovercraft. They've got so many things.
They also have a donut belly and a beer belly to rival anybody.
Well, ours don't here, but that's what you see all over your part of the country.
Definitely over here. There's some donut-eating MFs over here.
If you were to actually come see the Albuquerque Police Force, you would have a hard time fighting an overweight officer on our force.
Why? Yeah. I mean, is it just too many like chitlins and dumplings that they eat here or something?
Well, they start with they have 20-year retirement here, and they recruit very young. And so the people go on the dole after 20 years here. An officer can be retired at 45. They have higher physical agility standards to join the force, and they have higher physical agility to maintain your certification. So and being an arid, open climate where recreation is a lot more common here, you actually still see people out recreating here.
What?
In the humid climate, like where you live, from about late June till about the middle of September, everybody hibernates in their air-conditioned quarters here. Well, they don't do that here. I mean, there's people out jogging, bicycling, doing things. So you just have a more fit population here. The South tends to be more the obesity rates are higher. And then, I mean, we're catching up, not to say it's all panacea, but the Colorado, New Mexico, the states where health has been more of a conscious thing, the obesity rates are catching up and going up. But you don't see the stereotypical fat. Those are hard to find here when you see a cop here. They're generally less than 40, and they're generally very, very physically fit.
So over at The Intercept, this is a really disturbing article that we picked up. It's a black teenager, Damian Martin, begged police for help as he drowned. His death was ruled an accident. And it's a pretty short article, but there's an eight-minute video that goes with it. And it doesn't look like he was doing the right thing. He was fleeing from the police because him and some buddies were hanging out in a car, and allegedly the car may have been stolen. No idea if that part is true. However, so he's fleeing away, and in the neighborhood, there are like ponds in between the houses. I mean, it is Florida, so it's almost underwater anyway. And he tries to flee from the police, and he jumps into the water, and he comes up like two or something times and saying, help, 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 help. And then he went down the third time. So they like tased him either on his way into the water, or they tased him and it hit him around the water or around him in the water. And so he died. And yeah. Why wouldn't someone standing there on the sidelines watching someone say, please help, 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 I'm drowning. Why wouldn't you jump in and try and save someone, even if they are guilty of a crime or something? Why would you just say, whatever, die?
That's very troubling to me that at that point, once he got into a situation, yes, we don't need any mail. He did put himself in that position from fleeing the police. We totally understand that. But at the point you go into distress, then the duty of the police and the rescue people is to save life at that point. And he's no longer in a fleeing capacity. He's no longer running. He's in a situation where he's going up and down in water and needing help. And at that point, a rescue should have ensued. There will undoubtedly be a settlement of some sort in this as this unfolds. There's no justification they can have for not trying to save him.
They spoke to a forensic pathologist, something like that, to examine the autopsy, and they even found what looks like a tiny little cut. It looks, you know, I'm no medical expert, but it looks like it's a fresh-ish cut, and about the size of a, you know, like a pinprick kind of thing that might be from the head of a taser. Obviously, nobody knows, but that's what it looks like. And so, you know, did the taser hit the kid? And I'm kind of skeptical that the taser would hit the water and shock you. I mean, you might get shocked, but I don't know that it would be enough to hurt you in the water. That's my layperson opinion. So he got tased on his way into the water, and then the police wouldn't save him. That sounds like almost like murder, wrongful death. Like somebody's culpable for that, though.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see if we hear the outcome of it. But at the point he was in the water, there was a duty to try to save, and most law enforcement personnel are trained in rescue, and they would have been equipped to save him. Most officers can swim quite well that I've met.
And that was actually something else that they brought up, like the kid that went in there, like, well, he died because he couldn't swim, and they show videos of him like lapping people, like swimming like, you know, Michael Phelps or something.
They show videos of who lapping?
They show the videos of the kid swimming, you know, him swimming in this little pond, lake, whatever, between the houses. And he's an accomplished, like, not an accomplished swimmer. He's a proficient swimmer.
Well, I would imagine that would be rendered somewhat dubious by the tasing. If you've been tased.
Oh, of course, of course.
That would have wreck your muscular responses. I don't think you would be an accomplished swimmer at that point.
No. But what I'm saying is, like, they would say, well, he just couldn't swim and he drowned because he couldn't swim. It wasn't because of the tasing. That's what the police are saying. But they show videos, like family videos of the kid swimming with his friends in the pond or whatever. And like, no, he can swim. He totally can swim. That's not the problem.
So, yeah, he was not able to swim in that particular circumstance. But
correct. Absolutely. And, but, you know, so isn't that, could we make a somewhat parallel to, I can't think of the guy's name, the New York guy that was selling the cigarettes, the heavy dude, and he gets chokehold, and he's like, I can't breathe, and he dies? I mean, that seems at least somewhat similar.
Somewhat similar, but in that particular case, they were actually applying the pressure to him that choked him. In this particular case, they applied assuming the taser, that is a taser mark. They applied the taser to him, which rendered him unable to swim. And then they failed to provide any attempt to rescue. And of course, they're going to say that they were fearful of their safety because he was fleeing the police and they'll tell him what kind of danger. So therefore, we didn't, for our own safety, we had to sit back and see what was going to happen. That's what they're going to say.
Yeah. So here we are at a situation where the police can administer justice and execute without any sort of due process. All right, got it.
Well, they didn't execute. They failed to preserve and protect.
So my statement is taking it too far?
I think a little bit too far. They certainly failed to preserve and protect. When you're fleeing a person, once they're apprehended, at that point you become their protector.
Right.
Well, for all practical purposes, he was apprehended when he went into the canal. He had nowhere to go.
You can't swim super fast like you can sort of like running, unless you're Michael Phelps.
And at that particular point, they shifted from being in pursuit to his protector, and they should have protected him as best they were trained to do. And if no one there could swim, that will come out in the investigation. But I'm confident that some of those officers could have attempted a rescue.
Yeah, of course. So the final article is from NBC News. Hundreds of parents say kids wrongly taken from them after doctors misdiagnosed abuse. The profile article here is a couple, and their kid has something of a certain kind of condition that ends up, the kid gets a bunch of bruises from being in like the swingy seat in the house, and they take the kid to the doctor, and the doctor's like, this kid's being abused, and they take the kid away for like 4 months. They like forcibly remove the kid from the home because they think that the kid is having like shaken baby syndrome and all this other garbage. This is also disturbing, Larry. This is most likely coming from like the lefty pointed head kind of people of the child welfare stuff. At least that would be my take right off the bat, to have these policies. This is terrible that we would take kids away, that we don't have enough protections, to enough checks and balances to make sure that that people don't just have their families ripped apart needlessly.
This is a long story, and there's the first one of the videos of the couple sitting there with the two kids. They end up getting their kids back after the judge apologized and saying that they had a hearing which they didn't know about. They had an expert that would have contested what Child Protective Services. This is a personal one to me because I was in the Child Protective Services system from the time I was 8 years old until I aged out. And I've been kind of, having gone through my experience, I consider myself more informed than the average person. And I considered that the Child Protective Services, I think, acted largely appropriate in my case, in my family's case. So I've been very dubious of these claims. But we're people saying that their kids were taken for little or no reason. And I've used this to awaken myself to stuff that I did not know was happening. I know that I'm always dubious about mandatory reporting because people are required to report things because it's for the good of all. And sometimes they report something that may not be anything like what the people seeing the evidence think it was caused by. And so it's causing me to rethink what I've felt about Child Protective Services, because in my case, I felt like they acted appropriately all throughout my foster career, from the time I was 8 till I was 17 when I left. So I've been one who's been very tolerant of child welfare intervention, because it's all about keeping children safe. And we all want that thing. We want the children to be kept safe and out of abusive environments. But when you see people losing their kids that they've been caring for diligently with just virtually no due process and being taken almost at gunpoint, just shy of gunpoint, but with the force of law, and you see that that's not the America that we want. And if I'm going to be intellectually honest, I've got to say that these people are entitled to due process also. And you've got to have overwhelming evidence to take someone's kids away from them.
At the end of the article, the profile couple here, it says, every year since the Grahams have sent the doctor the child abuse pediatrician, a Christmas card with a photo of their family along with a note reminding her that she almost broke them apart. I am 100% with you on the statements that you just made that, of course, I don't, you know, you're going to find some sort of sociopath that wants children harmed, but by far and large, people do not want children harmed and would go to great lengths to protect children pretty much at any cost. But, and there are plenty of kids in the world that have been abused that needed protection when it wasn't available. And here you have what appears to be a very attractive couple and through a failure in the process have their family ripped apart. This has to been like, you know, a PTSD kind of level situation to have your kid, a kid taken away from the family like that. Then what are all the neighbors going to say? This is almost like being accused of a sexual offense, you know, and the cops show up and they ransack your house and all that stuff. And then everything just goes, well, sorry, we made a mistake. You know, where's your daughter? Child Protective Services took my kid. Like, what kind of horrible parent are you? How do you recover from that kind of scrutiny too?
Well, we've got a guy that comes to the legislature every year, and he's been coming for at least 5 years talking about how the system took his children away. And this has illuminated to me that maybe I ought to take him more seriously. But he rants in committee meetings about how the system is totally out of control, and he was denied due process, and perhaps he was. And like I say, it kind of was an eye-opener for me. That's why I put it in here, because I've been kind of insensitive to people who say my kids are taken away from me. Now, I know people in the registry face these intrusive investigations by Child Protective Services. We call it CYFD, Children, Youth, and Families. But the people have been victimized by the most flimsy, just mere being on the registry generates an intrusive inquiry from child welfare. That's not right. But I didn't realize that the system was breaking down to where these people were having their kids yanked away from them without any process at all, because theoretically you're only supposed to be able to take a kid for just a short number of hours without some evidence. And then there's supposed to be an adversarial process take place.
Yeah. They took the kid for many months. Oh, it says 14 months later. Oh, that was a different case. Not the profile. I thought they took him for just several months. I mean, I don't mean just.
So the interview with the judge, I think, said that how sorry he was that it happened, you know, if he'd known. Mm-hmm. And then they got $100,000 in attorney's fees back.
Right. And so this is then also just like someone that gets wrongly convicted and they just say, oh, sorry, we made a mistake, and open the door and let you go home. And, you know, you lost some amount of time of your life. You know, this kid ended up spending some time with some foster kids, not questioning whether they treated the kid correctly or not. I'm not really even challenging the intent of anybody in the system, just that there should have been something else to slow this thing down to take the kid away from the parents for it to be erroneous.
Well, that's why we insist on due process.
We have to
build in protections where if a child has to be taken on an emergency basis, the evidence has to be overwhelming that the child is in danger. And then that can only last for a short number of days before you have to be put to a burden of proving that child was in danger and that home needs intervention, or else that child has to be returned. If we just follow due process, if we realize that due process costs money, and we accept that, and we dedicate ourselves to giving people due process, a lot less of this will happen. The reason why this happened in the first couple's case is because they did not follow due process. They just went ahead and acted.
Right.
You know, due process is inconvenient, folks, but that's why we have it.
Right. But isn't this, Child Protective Services and whatever else you want to call it, don't they have some sort of like a diversionary path? Like they have the authority to like go remove kids without doing any, like they can just go do it. They're almost like, I don't want to say above the law, but they have those authorities.
They do, but under very limited circumstances where the child is in danger of neglect or abuse. And then they have to go through a due process. I mean, you can show up on Child Protective Services in most states can show up and take a child. Yes. But it's only for a very brief amount of time before that family is entitled to a hearing. And apparently the system broke down. They did not give them a hearing.
They did not let them have the opportunity to contest what the report had come in about what that doctor claimed that the skull fractures had to be not the result of an accident, but from abuse. And the doctor was wrong. Yeah, right. their evidence was wrong, but they didn't allow the family the opportunity to be heard. Due process would have fixed this.
I got nothing. I really don't. I'm it's so hard to think about a kid that is getting the crap beat out of him by a drunk dad that needs protection, needs immediate intervention. There's going to be a victim in this. On one side or the other, I don't the margin for error on this is so small of a child literally dying versus having a kid stripped away from the family. I don't think there's enough margin of error for this to work.
Well, that's why they're entitled. If they come in and there's a child bruised and bleeding, and they appear to be in danger of having not been fed, or that they have been abused, they can yank the child. But then they have to go through due process right away. Yeah. They have to put their case together and bring it before a judicial officer and say, this is why we want this child out of the home. And they have to give that family an opportunity to be heard. That costs money, but that's what we have to do. We're talking about taking families and ripping them apart. I'm sorry, due process is expensive.
Right.
But that's what we have to do. If you don't want to do that, then that's what a society that's civilized does. We just don't come in and grab people because we have bad vibes. We go through a process of showing that child needs the protection because of a real threat. But we don't get to decide how we would like children to be raised. That's up to the family, as long as they're not being abused or neglected.
Well, Larry, let's close it out with a listener question. And this came from a Patreon supporter named Mike. He said, just catching up on older episodes, listening to 100 now. Man, you need to get caught up. You're like 5 weeks behind. On the Halloween sign part, not sure if this was argued or if it matters in Georgia. In New Jersey, a judge has a hearing to determine what tier an SO must be classified as. Tier 3 requires community notification, 2 only to schools, daycare, etc. Tier 1 is law enforcement only. If a sheriff requires that an SO warning sign be posted on Halloween in front of the house for a tier 1 or 2 person, wouldn't that be violating the order of the court? And I think to explain that slightly different, that the tier 1 and 2 only have limited kind of notifications, not the entire world. But if you then post a sign in somebody's house, then everybody knows.
So in a state like New Jersey, where they have that type of system, that would be a very good argument to make. Now, in the case of the two sheriffs in Georgia, they did not say that the person was a sex offender. They merely just had a sign that said, no trick-or-treating at this residence. This message provided by Spalding County Sheriff, and this message provided by the Butts County Sheriff. So you could arguably say that they were not announcing that person was a sex offender. What made that argument fall apart for them in the court hearing was that the sheriff had taken great efforts to announce it to the local media that those signs were going on sex offenders. He'd used his social media and he'd gone to the media, newspaper, TV, and everything. So that argument was not very, very strong for him that there was no correlation between the sign and them being a sex offender. But if you were to do that without announcing the person was a sex offender, then it would be a more defensible position. But in New Jersey, unlike Georgia, Georgia doesn't have that system. Everybody who's registered in Georgia is listed on the internet.
Right.
So therefore you would not be disturbing anything. And the Georgia system doesn't delineate in terms of internet publication for people that are lower moderate risk, and they do have a leveling system, but the leveling system doesn't get you any benefit in terms of internet publication. It does get you the benefit of being eligible for removal if you can get yourself down to a level 1 in Georgia. So he's got a great question. In New Jersey, that would probably be a very compelling argument. In Georgia, it wasn't such a compelling argument. It's not what won the day.
All right. And then he has a second question. It says, consider that a listener – oh, says sorry. Anyway, one more. How can New Jersey deny bail to everyone through a recent law and still be considered constitutional? Not many are fighting about it. While it may be a better option for some, bail is specifically addressed to the United States Constitution. And we had some pre-show chat with the questioner to clarify and tighten things up. What do you have to say about that question?
Well, I happen to share the concerns about the states are moving away from cash bail. And although the cash bail system is not perfect, it is very discriminatory. A person who's charged with the exact same crime, who has roughly the same criminal history, if they set roughly the same amount of cash bond, and that's the way they had scales, for example, a misdemeanor would be $500 or $1,000. So if you had three misdemeanors, the bond would be $3,000. And a fourth degree felony in our state, that's we have four degrees of felony. A fourth degree felony might be a $5,000 or $2,500 bond. If you had three of those, it'd be a $7,500 bond. Well, a person with three fourth degree felonies with the same criminal record that may not be able to raise the $750 for the bonds and the collateral would be at an enormous disadvantage for their defense, and they would be in a much weaker position to negotiate a plea because they're not out. And they're going to want to plead to get out of custody. So I recognize that. But on the other hand, what you have that's replaced it is they use these risk models, and they take into account your age, your gender, the number of times you've had experience with the law. If you've ever had a no-show, they give points, and then they rate you as a likelihood to appear or to be a problem to appear, and the severity of the conditions of release are tailored around that scoring card of how many charges you've got, how many you've had, and all these factors. It's kind of the Andy perfect world of the computer deciding it. So the computer spits out an algorithm based on all that, and then they fashion these conditions of release that you're subjected to. And you may sit in jail for quite some time till they find an appropriate arrangement of conditions that will assure that you are released. So his question is, does that violate the Constitution? And the answer is, I don't know. The answer is, does the right to bail mean the right to release pending trial, or does it mean the right to pay cash to be released pending trial? We don't know the answer to that. What did the framers mean when they said the right to bail? Did that mean the right to be released and presumed innocent? Or did it mean the right to spend money to be released from jail? What did they mean? I do not know.
You were there. How do you not know?
Well, they didn't let me participate in that part of the... I was pretty young then. But on a serious note, we don't know whether this violates the Constitution or not, because this is a new trend. And the way that that pre-release is being handled, I don't like every aspect of how, because I believe the most minimal restraint possible should be imposed on a person who's not yet convicted. And I find a lot of the conditions imposed to be way excessive for a person presumed innocent. But on the other hand, just because you have $7,500 under the old system, you'd pay that walk away with virtually no conditions except show up in court. And you'd sit in jail and rot and lose your job. If you had a job, you'd lose your job because you didn't have $7,500. Is that the America that you want? I mean, that's a very compelling question. Is that the kind of country you want where money buys justice?
Well, yeah. If Bill Gates does felony jaywalking, there's no amount of bail that he couldn't come up with, and someone else making minimum wage delivering pizzas or whatever, you know, they have an insignificant amount of bail, and it would be life-altering.
Yeah, I keep hearing that felony jaywalking. I'm not aware of that being a crime anywhere to be as a felony level.
I'll find it for you. I'll find it somewhere. Some bullshit city somewhere, some little county has it just to entrap people with
but,
that.
But the point is relevant that those jailhouse schedules that they had, those did not take into account that it would be a relatively modest imposition on some, and they could have bail posted and arranged within hours, and that was not a fair system either. So what in the pre-show discussion we mentioned that the bonding industry had challenged that in New Mexico, and they didn't get any traction. He said they were making the same challenge in New Jersey. I will be interested and hopeful that we'll be informed as to what the courts do with it, because I just don't know what did they mean by the right to bail.
Certainly. All right. And you know what always excites me, Larry? When we have new patrons. And we had two this week.
That's what I heard.
You heard that?
And who are they?
Well, one of them, I really don't know his name. His name is Drill Sergeant, and I'm sure his first name is not Drill and last name Sergeant, but that's what he's listed as. And so thank you so very much. And then an absolutely monstrous, over-the-top, big, gigantic thank you shout-out to Scott, who did a pretty significant contribution to our efforts here at the podcast of Registry Matters.
So, well, yes, and we thank everyone who supports us. It inspires me to get out of my aching, whining, complaining about feeling bad, and get over here and start going through all these articles we've been saving all week and making sure I've read them, and to try to sound reasonably intelligent. And we do appreciate the support. It's very kind. And we hope, as I said, well, I think last week or the week before, we hope we're actually helping people understand. I think we got a compliment from our super patron that has just gone through the process of beginning to be removed from the registry or petition. And he said that he saw evidence of some of the stuff I say being actually the way it works.
Yeah, he said I wanted to have him on as a guest to talk about his process, but he doesn't want to do anything that might hamper his ability because it gets delayed a little bit. But he says, all I can really tell you is that what took place yesterday, I suppose I could do that. It's the way that it went down. He said, a lot of what Larry has been saying for a long time, I have seen in action.
So
either he's a crackpot just like you, or maybe what you're saying is actually true. One or the other, not sure which.
Well, it's like when we had the Narcelin action call, and I said to the attorney that was on, and I don't think it's relevant to name the attorney, but it's not that long ago. And I said, having a psychosexual evaluation is a must. And he said, well, no, it's not a must. And I didn't mean literally it was a must. I mean, you can do it without a psychosexual evaluation. It's not required. Yeah. The statute does not require that you have a psychosexual evaluation. But I can tell you this, if you don't have one, you've just stacked the deck hard against yourself, because the judge needs that to justify letting you off. And it's not required. It doesn't say in the statute you need to have a chat with a prosecutor in the jurisdiction. But in most states that have that process, you have to file it in the county where you were convicted, unless you were convicted in another state. And in which case you get to file in Georgia, for example. If you're convicted outside Georgia, you can file it in whatever county you live in, which gives you the opportunity to set your own venue, because you can move to a county where the removal petitions approvals are higher. But if you don't go talk to the prosecutor, you're a fool, because you need to find out what their position is going to be before you get to court. It's not required. It doesn't say in the statute, but it's the prudent thing to do. So hopefully that's what he's talking about. These things I'm telling you, you're not required to do them. You're not required to have an attorney either. But I can tell you one thing. If you don't have an attorney, just like the one in Clayton County that was an attorney and represented himself. You remember who we're talking about? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you see how well that worked out for him.
I do.
When you go sit down to talk to the prosecutor, first of all, they're not going to sit down with you as the person. They're going to avoid talking to you, because that's not the way the system's designed to work. But if they were to sit down with you, when you say, what do you think of me? They're not going to tell you what they think of you. They're not going to say, well, actually, I think you're a creeper, and I didn't think you got enough time to start with, and we're going to be fighting like hell to keep on the registry. They're not going to say that to you, because they have kids, they have vehicles, they don't want their tires or their throat slashed or anything like that, so they're not going to tell you. But your attorney will be able to get that information, and they can come back to you and say, well, Andy, you know, I've taken your money, and we can go through with this, but I can tell you one thing, their temperature hasn't dropped one bit since you were convicted 17 years ago. And they're going to be bringing up all the dirt that they argued 17 years ago all over again. And they're going to be fighting tooth and nail to keep you on the registry. Wouldn't you like to know that before you go to the hearing?
We should just go in guns blazing, man, and say FYP.
Yeah. I mean, you would want to know that, because then you know whether you want to keep pouring money into the sinkhole. Because yes, the judge still could let you off without the prosecutor's acquiescence. but it certainly diminishes your chances. So you want as much information as you can get. So therefore, you want an attorney who knows how the process works and who's willing to go and have conversations and find out what it would take to get them to at least take no position. It's rare they're going to endorse your removal, but if you can get them to take no position, that's a victory.
Well, Larry, this is by far the longest we've ever recorded. And if you've made it this far in listening, you need to sign up over on Patreon, even at $1, because half of this podcast is going to be released on Patreon. So if you want to get all the extra content, just $1 a month, they'll get you there. And otherwise, to speed this whole thing up, just go to registrymatters.co. All the links are there, and you can find where to do phone numbers, emails, all that stuff. As always, Larry, you are amazing. You're the best, and I thank you so very much, and I will talk to you soon.
Well, thanks, Andy, and thanks, everyone, for listening. We've got about 70 people in chat.